InsideHomeRecording.com.
Well, one of the challenges when we were putting this event together was, who do we get to do the keynote address for this event? Today's the day where we're trying to bring music and technology together and talk about the convergence of the two. And the world is changing so fast for all of us. You know, how do we move forward? And as we were putting this list together, I remember at one of the meetings, somebody said, we should get Thomas Dolby. I said, Thomas Dolby? And they said, yeah. I mean, Thomas has been involved. I mean, he's somebody that was a musician first and was involved with making records. He's a 5-time Grammy nominee. He, not only as a feature performer, has done session work with artists as diverse as like Def Leppard and Foreigner, playing keyboards with them. And then, at a certain point, he devoted his energy towards working on technology and formed a company called Beatnik that created some of the technology that's allowed audio to be embedded into the internet and then into mobile phones. And I just felt like he represented, in a way, who many of the other people we discussed as doing this address, really that sort of convergence that we're here to discuss today. So I'm very proud that he decided to join us today, and we're going to do a very quick laptop change, but I want to welcome Thomas Dolby.
It's been a while since I addressed an audience of mostly musicians in the music business. You know, I've been doing a lot of tech things over the last few years, and it's a slightly different mentality. But it's really nice to be talking to musicians. You know, I'm a lot more comfortable in a way talking to you guys than businessmen and technologists. Actually, I think the last time I talked to a music business oriented crowd was the Association of Music Publishers and Collection Societies in Washington, D.C. It was a good few years ago, and I told them that maybe they should sort of wake up and realize that technology was going to change the models that they'd been used to for the last, you know, 70, 80 years, and you could almost hear the hiss go around the room. The good news is that, you know, as in most things, when you start out being the sort of enfant terrible, as the years go on, you end up being quite a moderate and then eventually a conservative. So I guess I'm now a pillar of the establishment as far as the music technology. So, you know, I was thinking about what to talk to you guys about today and looking at some of the agenda for the conference. And I figured, well, you know, I've been in the music business nearly 30 years now. My first ever job in the music industry was like 1977, I think. And, you know, but I've taken the last 10 or 12 years as a sort of hiatus from the music business. And it's given me a unique perspective on it. I sometimes feel a bit like Austin Powers, who sort of went to sleep for a decade and woke up, and now there's all these shiny new toys. You know? And it's rather fabulous. And the reason, actually, I took 12 years off, it was never meant to be 12 years, it was meant to be a year or two. The beginning of the 90s, I'd gotten very disillusioned, really, with the music industry and the way it was going, and I'd always been involved in technology. And I saw these fascinating opportunities, but they were frustratingly still just out of reach. You know, there wasn't enough bandwidth, there wasn't enough mind share really in the business or the tech communities. And so I decided to move from Hollywood to Silicon Valley and focus my efforts there. And one thing led to another, and my company, Beatnik, had a sort of rough ride for a few years and ended up being pretty successful, but it took a lot longer than I'd hoped to get there. But it does mean that a couple of things, that now in the last year I've come back to doing music full time. Beatnik really doesn't need me anymore, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a while. But and technology has become a lot more mature, and a lot of the things that I was dreaming about in late 80s, early 90s are now a reality for musicians. And then secondarily, you know, the business models have just really changed, and a lot of the things that were annoying and frustrating, you know, to musicians from my generation relating to the constraints of the music industry are starting to go away. And I think the general public read about the woes of the major record labels and stuff, but personally, I don't know how you guys feel about it. I think it's a fantastic time right now. For musicians and for music fans, it's just the best time ever, and I think the people that are going to really take advantage of that are still in high school or college. You know, it's not really us, but the next generation coming through are going to really reap the benefits of all of the changes that are taking place. So, you know, I'm thinking about what I talk about today. I did something I do from time to time, which I call hard drive archaeology. I have a shelf in my garden shed where I put all of my old hard drives, and they sort of stack up, you know, over the years. And so if you dig down a few layers, you can actually find some really interesting relics. I found one out of a Mac 512K SE or something that I decided to dig into and find some clips that I would use today. And it's sort of interesting. So you go down a few layers and you can sort of carbon date them by hooking them up and looking at the dates on some of them. And it's actually quite interesting to just select a few files and sort them by date and then just like run them in sequence, because it gives you this really interesting little sort of animated view of a period of years. And so it actually produced some quite interesting results, which I thought would be a good sort of basis for me to chat to you today. So I had a folder in there called Synths. And I thought this would be a nice place to start. This was my first ever synthesizer, circa 1978, a Transcendent 2000. You know, up to that point, synths have been modular things with lots of wires and routing and stuff, and they were only really, you know, university music departments had modular synths, and nobody else could really afford them. So if you lived in a place like Sheffield or Leeds or whatever, you could sort of hang around at the back of the university music departments, and every now and then in the dumpster you'd find something really great. And since it was all modular, you know, if you put all these things together, eventually you could hook them up and make yourself a synthesizer. And that's very much the way people like the Human League and Cabaret Voltaire and Throbbing Gristle and so on started. And that was really roots for me. You know, I was growing up in London. I was a teenager in London. The punk movement was going on, fantastic socially. You know, great to go out and be a rebel and shock people on the streets, and it got you laid and everything. But there was this kind of parallel thing going on, you know, which is the electronic music scene, and that was what was really fascinating to me. But it was expensive and it was out of reach of most musicians. So the Transcendent 2000 was actually a kit-built synthesizer, and I didn't build this one myself. I found it in Exchange and Mart, which is sort of, I guess, was the Craigslist of the 1970s in London. And so this was my first synth. I went from that, and this cost me, a mere £1,200 or something at the end of the 70s. And I had this and a Tiap two-track tape recorder. And the way I used to record my drum parts, and I'm not kidding about this, is I'd set a metronome running. I'd program, a snare part on my little Moog here. And I'd sit there with the metronome and one track of the tape recorder going, wind back the tape recorder, program in a kick drum, you know, a bit of filter, close it down, and then I'd be going all the way through. And it was not all that in time, and it was very laborious. And I was sort of puzzling over this one night, and I went out to a disco, and it was one of those nights where nobody shows up to dance, and I was just sitting there with a beer watching this empty dance floor, and these pulsating red and green lights on the floor, and I thought, wait a minute, how do they do that? It must be some sort of electronic way of doing that. I can't imagine some DJ is sitting there, you know, like doing this with his four fingers. So I investigated and I found this device that they had on the DJ desk, which was basically just outputting positive and negative voltages. And since most synths in those days, this is before MIDI, they used to run on an 8 DVA system with a gate, I could actually, with a soldering iron, I could actually hook up this little lighting unit to my Moog and get it to play the drums, and it was a lot less laborious, a lot more in time than I was with my fingers. So in fact, the next time you listen to the drum break at the end of She Blinded Me with Science, you're actually listening to a disco lighting console. Now, when I mentioned this to some technologists at a music tech show in Olympia, London, this would be around about 1980, there was a company called PPG out of Germany which had made a lot of equipment for Tangerine Dream for their show, and they had this fantastic thing called Henry, but they called it a PPG 340-380 wave computer, and this was actually designed for Tangerine Dream's lighting show. And so when I told them the story about the disco lighting console, I said, we have a much more sophisticated or deficient disco lighting console for you to play your drums. So they built me this little drum unit as well, which was basically a very simple sampler. It had eight little locations to put samples in. They were 8-bit, I think 8 kilohertz or something like that. And so that became my next system. And the good thing about this was, you know, A, it had a screen, which is, you know, way impressive to have a computer screen on stage. And it had two little micro cassette units in the top two units here, And so each song that I did on stage...
A fire emergency has been reported in the building.
Okay.
Hello again.
So yeah, a little bit of perspective on the first chapter of my experience in the music business versus now. And I think this is really important. I mean, a lot of you guys were around the first time out as well, and you've seen these changes taking place. But as I mentioned earlier, I'm just very optimistic about what's going on now. I think it's a great time and place to be here. Here's some of the things that I've found the second time out. I guess the first is in the area of recording and studio technology. I mean, obviously, as you know, probably the recording studio I've got right here in my laptop is way more powerful than one I would have had to pay $200 an hour for, you know, in the 80s. And so the first big change, I think, for musicians is that we no longer necessarily need to go into a really expensive studio to record. And that has an extremely strong knock-on impact on the economics of our lives at the end of the day. And the main thing is that you no longer have to go into debt or get a huge loan or advance in order to even get on the scorecard as far as recording your music. And this is a really powerful thing. I mean, you know, one of my biggest beefs really about my early recording is that because I had to get, you know, I had to find somebody to loan me money to record, I ended up sort of giving the game away. I know I'm going to address this a little bit later on one of the panels. But the net result of all of that is that, you know, all of those recordings I did, I don't own them. Somebody else owns them with three letters in their title. And they own them in perpetuity. So those masters that I recorded, in order to have the privilege of going into the studio to record those, I had to therefore give away ownership of the resulting recordings for the rest of my life. And, you know, this is sort of crazy when you think about it. I mean, most of us can't afford to buy a house for cash, so we need a loan to do it. So the mortgage company uses the house as collateral to secure the loan, but they don't own the house at the end of the day. So long as you pay off your debts, it's your house. And for some reason, that model never really applied to the music business. I mean, when I started out, and I have to say, you know, I first started looking for a record deal in about 1980, so things were already a lot better for me than they were for, let's say, the Beatles. But something that was in common was that there was, if you wanted to get your music out there, there was only one game in town, and that was to go to a label and try and get noticed and try and get signed, and then having got signed, navigate the politics of the record label and try and get them to promote you, market you, get you on the radio, etc. And only then did the public get to decide whether they liked your music or not. I don't know about you, but for me as a songwriter, I mean, I was delighted to get a record deal, but every time I sat down at the piano to write a song, what was in the back of my mind was not the audience, it was the head of A&R at the record company, what he was going to think about it, and if he liked it enough to take it into the marketing meeting on Monday morning, and if they liked it enough to take it to the radio programming guys, and if it got that far, the radio programming guys might send it out to radio and hopefully they would like it. And if they liked it, the retailers might stock it. And only then would the public get to judge whether I've written a good song. So there I am sitting at the piano, I'm finding these chord changes, I'm jotting down pieces of lyrics, and I'm thinking about this whole obstacle course I'm going to have to get through before the public will ever get to decide. But, I mean, the way I'd like to write is that if I find a chord change and it hits me emotionally, I get a certain feeling out of it. I just want to believe that out there, there is a public that are going to feel the same way about it. You know, they're going to feel emotionally the same way as they do, or a line of lyrics. They're going to pick up the same connotation that I'd intended. And the good news now is that I can write a song on the plane on the way home. When I get home, hit an upload button, and I'll get, you know, by the time I'm even home from the airport, there'll be half a dozen comments on the song on my blog. Not that I intend to do that, but I could. And if a month from now I think that it sucks, or I want to change the lyrics, or I want to change the intro, there's no harm at all in putting up a new version and deleting the old one. Now there's two versions out there, all the better. And I just think this is a fantastic state of affairs. It closes down the loop between the musician and the audience to such an extent that it completely changes my lifestyle. In the old days, I had to write songs in convenient batches of 10 or 12, and then go through this whole, you know, recording cycle and wait for it to get out. I would get booked in to do, you know, promotional tours and actual tours and so on, and the marketing department has allocated a 2-3 week window where they're going to be focused, you know, they're going to prioritize my record and then they're going to move on to the next artist. But if, God forbid, the record doesn't catch fire during that 2-3 week period, it's basically back to the drawing board. It's basically back to scratch. Start thinking about next year and your next album times. And that was really depressing. That was really depressing living under those kind of conditions. On top of which, at the end of the day, you know, when the royalty statement comes, and you should be feeling really good about things because you know you sold 100,000 records, the bad news is that actually this whole process ran you up such a large debt that, you know, there's no royalty check this quarter, you know, but we're keeping our fingers crossed for next quarter. And through all of this, the dirty little secret of the music industry was called music publishing. And if you're fortunate enough to be the songwriter on these records, as opposed to, let's say, the bass player in a rock band who didn't write any of the songs and is on a $400 a week retainer, then you suddenly find out somewhere along the line that you have the equivalent of a kind of Swiss bank account, which is called your music publishing. Because this is this giant hat that, you know, these pennies get put into all the time. And thank God they can't really be touched by all the idiocies of the way the record companies would rack up these debts. So, and if you go into a music publisher, even very big music publishers, and it's shocking, at least it wasn't those days, you see papers piled high, gathering dust, and people half asleep. And every now and then a phone rings, like, hello, yeah, okay, yeah, all right, I'll fax it to you. And it's like, every now and then, you know, the till goes ka-ching. But they have absolutely no idea what they have in their catalog. And there was really no reason for them to be proactive with your songs at all. And the music publishing world, in my opinion, the way it's been set up, it's ridiculously weighted in the favour of the writer. I mean, I can't believe the fact that, you know, 25 years after the fact, a fax will come out, you know, in my fax machine, all I've got to do is sign it and fax it back, and I've just made another $11,000, you know, for some sort of South American, you know, option on some synchronization right or something like that. I mean, in Silicon Valley terms, that's just unheard of. The piece of intellectual property still has that kind of value decades later. And the reason that it's so ridiculously weighted in the favor of the music publishers and the writers is because the record contracts were so heinous. So very often, you know, artists and bands and managers would turn a blind eye to the ridiculous way that the record company accounting was done because they've got this secret little slush pond called the music publishing world. And the whole infrastructure of the music business has grown up around this, and that association of music publishers that I was talking to, I mean, of course they're half asleep, and of course they don't want change, because for decades they've been sitting on this incredible, you know, built-in cash pile where it's just like racking up. It doesn't really matter whether they go to work in the morning or not. You know, the money will keep piling up there, so of course they didn't want that change. Hey, all of that stuff drove me absolutely crazy. You know? It drove me really crazy because I was not one of the artists that would, you know, just sort of go into the record label and grab a few long-distance phone calls and go and sign autographs on the way out. You know, I actually went around from department to department asking people what they did because I was interested in how this whole thing worked. And you know, it was deeply shocking to me because in most cases it was, well, we don't really do anything, you know. we love your new satin tour jacket. So, I mean, I suffered from the fact that, you know, being a thinking person, you know, and getting under the hood of all of this, you know, this stuff drove me crazy. The other thing that drove me crazy, and this is sort of a double-edged sword, really, you know, I never really thought of myself as a mainstream artist. I never set out to be in the pop charts or whatever. And, you know, I made my first album, and it got critically really well reviewed, didn't sell very well, didn't get on the radio. And that's kind of basically what I expected. You know, I thought it'd be great if the record company will fund my music hobby for a few more albums. You know, that was kind of my state of mind. But I was very interested, as I have always been, into the new forms of media and new ways to experiment. So music videos were starting to get popular at the beginning of the 80s, and I'd always fancied myself as a film director. So I managed to persuade my record company that if I only spent 10,000 quid, they would let me direct my own music video. So I made She Blinded Me With Sight. And it so happened to coincide with the period where MTV was starting to get really powerful in the US. It had just gotten into the major cities, and hip people were staying home to watch MTV on a Saturday night instead of going out to a club and then talking about it. And it was so influential at that point that actually radio stations were looking to MTV to pick their playlists. So, very much to my surprise, I had this sudden chart hit with that song, and then a few more afterwards. And the record company at this point, and everybody around me, assumed that I hit, you know, I struck gold. And this only happens once in a while when somebody does this. And the assumption that they all clicked into was, okay, now you've got the formula right, you're going to milk it. Don't tell me that you're going off to Brussels, Belgium to make an esoteric album with strings and trombones and ethnic percussion. Please don't tell me that. Please tell me you're going back in that damn studio with your damn same damn co-producer and you're going to make a string more, you know, she's blinding me with geography. And they were just incredulous when I said that wasn't what I actually wanted to do. They just could not believe it. And they were very, very critical of me. And they talked among themselves and said, the artist always like this, isn't it? It's like they don't realise how lucky they are. You know? It's like we put them up there in the charts and they just have no idea how rarely this ever happens and how rarely it all falls into place. And, you know, why? He's an intelligent guy. Why doesn't he realise that this is what he should be doing from their point of view? And, you know, so I sold records, and on those records were the very accessible, very fluffy, kind of catchy things like Hyperactive and Shibari and Science and so on. But also on those records were very personal, very atmospheric, very intimate songs like Budapest by Blimp or Scream Kiss or some of my other things. And I was aware that hundreds of thousands of people now were in possession of those songs. But I had no way of telling whether that stuff, which was most important to me, had really connected with an audience. And if I went to the record company and said, why are people buying this exactly? They couldn't really answer. They couldn't really answer the question. No. They sort of said, they could give me statistics, they could give me facts, but they had no ability to analyse why people had bought the stuff or what they thought of it, if that or the next level. And they just thought that these units would come out of the woodwork, you know, in droves, because they did last time. And their way to get the news out was to buy the back cover of Billboard magazine or buy a 30-second slot on network TV or whatever. And they just assumed that, God, you hit that many million people. Hopefully, all we need is 1% of them to be interested and we're going to sell bucket loads. That was kind of the mentality. And I hated that as well. And artistically, it troubled me because I didn't really like the idea that if the answer was I was duping people into buying an album full of personal, intimate, esoteric songs by hooking them with a catchy single, then that was kind of depressing. If, on the other hand, I had succeeded in something which in a lot of ways was a much greater achievement, which was to do, you know, very personal, very esoteric music, you know, to a large number of people, then I didn't really need to be doing the catchy singles and I could sort of skip that next time. But there were no answers out there for me. There's absolutely no ability to get that kind of feedback. Okay, well, I'm going to fast forward a bit, because the good news is that all of those problems have been addressed. You know, it's like after being away for 12 years and coming back, we're not quite there in all the areas, but I mean, it's just such a joy for me to be making music now. And I just feel so much better about it on every level. I feel so much better about the fact that, you know, I'm not investing ahead of the curve. I look at every payment that I make out of my account, and I think of it in terms of, well, is this going to be justified? Is this going to make me some money back? If it is, then great. If it isn't, then I consider it. Is it a luxury? You know, is this something that artistically I want to do? I want to spend this kind of money, even though I'm not likely to make it back. And that's the way that I judge what's a good idea. It's only a good idea if it makes sense economically as well. It's so different from the old days, you know, just let other people, you know, handle all that stuff. Secondarily, I can record the stuff for next to nothing. I have a garden shed, actually. I don't even have a studio. It used to be a recording studio. Now I have a garden shed, and my laptop's in it, and a few other toys. And you know, that's great for me. I look out over the Pacific Ocean, and I see migrating whales. And it's a lovely way to work out, like a 10-foot commute. Very often, I'm still in my bedroom slippers and bathrobe at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then having done that, I now have the option of not necessarily thinking, okay, that's three songs now I've got done for the new album. You know, I can put a song out as a single, I can make an EP, I can send it to my sync licensing agent and say, look, this might make a good, great TV theme or a song in a movie. I can get it remixed, I can put it out under a different name, I can, there's just so many more options now about what I can do with the music. And this is great because most artists don't, you know, just come up with songs in convenient batches of 10 or 12 and, you know, every 18 months repeat the cycle. You know, most of us are pretty, you know, spasmodic, pretty irregular in the way that we output stuff. So, I mean, I love that. I also love the fact that from the point of view of the production of the album, there are so many companies now that make that easy for artists. And admittedly, many of these companies are focused on what you might call the long tail. You know, the tens of thousands of artists who are local bands that have a bit of a following, or you know, maybe even call it the sort of the, you know, the vanity CDs. And but the fact is, the tools that they come up with to do this for, you know, for pressing, for artwork, for hosting your website, for selling CDs online. You know, hear from Derek Sivers later on this afternoon, but I discovered CD Baby in about 2001, and I'd had a 40th birthday party in my hometown just for a few friends, and we recorded it, and I made a CD initially just to give to the people that came to the party, and they all said, this is great, you should re-release this. So I thought, well, I don't want to make a big fanfare about it, but I would like to get it out there. So I discovered CD Baby. I just can't tell you what a great site this is. It's just fantastic. If you log in as a musician, I'm sure many of you have done it. But, you know, I can see, I have complete control over the way my stuff is presented. They will encode it for me. They will take clips and put them up. I can look at how many they have in their inventory. They have a good relationship with, well, I use disc makers for pressing. I can order online an extra 500 copies from disc makers. They'll send them directly to CD Baby. They just, you know, next time I check in, my inventory just went up by 500. Every week I get a check. Based on the sales of the last week. And if I want, I can see who the people were that found, that bought the CD, how they got there. I can read their comments. I can redirect them to my own website. I can download an Excel file, which gives me a database of the email addresses and so on of all the people that bought the music. And that gives me a core audience, a core public, which next time around I can go out and build on. So if I sold, 2,000 of the last one, you do a mail out to them, and that's a good starting point. I might sell 500, within the first couple of weeks of the new one, and then build on top of that. And I love the site because it's entirely artist-driven. You're never under the impression that, because of this big deal they've got with Sony or whoever it may be, their agenda is slightly mixed up. You never have that mistrust that you often get, where, these guys are really advocates for me, or are they working for somebody else? Very clear as a member of CD Baby, as a musician on there, that they're entirely your advocate. And you get email messages from them with all of these tools, tips, and so on. When I play live, I have a merch table, I have a CD credit card swiping machine, and which was provided for me by CD Baby. And we send all the slips in, a week later, get a check, less 9%, which is great. 91% of this I'm keeping myself, it's just fantastic. $4 for a CD, I sell a CD for 15, maybe a buck and a half to make it. I'm making $9-$10 per CD versus, if I was lucky, 90 cents in the old days. Automatic checkbox to distribute the songs on the CD to iTunes, Rhapsody, and all the rest of it. And once again, at the 99 cents on the song sales for, on iTunes, I'm keeping, 60 cents, something like that, 70 cents. I don't know, my old EMI songs are on there, I get 6 cents a download from iTunes. And I can't complain because they own the master. That's just a huge difference, just night and day difference. The one thing I'm missing, just to sort of, start to wrap this up, is that I guess I'm kind of fortunate, given my business background over the last 10 years and so on, I've gotten able to refocus my mind on sort of different aspects of the whole process. Not as naive as I was as an artist the first time. But the one thing I'm really missing is that, because I'm able to do all of these things, I can do them, but I kind of get a migraine. In a lot of ways, before long, I start to glaze over and I'd rather be just focused on the music and the artistic side of it. I've asked around in the last few months to see what kind of new companies there are, new models, that can help me get from a stage of, yes, I can publish and distribute. What are the chances of getting a feature on iTunes? What are the chances of getting this to the music supervisor on the OC? see if she wants to use a song in an episode. It's like, you know, in other words, how do I elevate myself above the white noise of all the other stuff out there? I don't want to be part of the long tail. I want to be one of the creme de la creme. And I kind of imagine in my mind's eye that out there somewhere is a company which is sort of a hybrid between a management company and an online promotions company. I'd like them to take certain things off my plate, the accounting, supervising the artwork, insurance, just sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill stuff day to day. But then in addition, I'd like them to know what it takes to get the editorial thumbs up from iTunes rather than just getting a song on there. And in order for them to know that, they're going to have enough clout that they can get a conversation with that guy that's the editor at iTunes. So maybe this is a company that has a stable of 10, 12 acts, and all of these tasks they're sort of aggregating on behalf of the whole stable of acts. And I would, you know, ideally there would be half a dozen companies like that, and I'd like to go and meet with those half a dozen companies. I'd like them to pitch me what kind of commission they want to take on my sales versus what they can do for me. And I imagine that the numbers are going to be sort of flipped from the ones that I started out with, where I was making, you know, maybe 12% if I was lucky on a record sale. I'd be willing to pay that 15, 20%, something like that, of my sales, at least for a, you know, foreseeable future, to a company that could really help me get that stuff out there. There are a lot of new models out there. A lot of people will sort of talk the talk. And I think if you're a small company, a startup working in that area, maybe got a couple of, disillusioned former company executives on your board or whatever it may be. You've got some VC money or somebody's rich uncle is willing to loan you something. It's very hard to figure out where the dividing lines are. You know, what exactly is our piece of the puzzle that we're going to do? What's the service that we do for musicians? So for the business people here today, you know, my recommendation as to how to find a niche in all of this is you have to be artist-driven. You have to figure out what kind of services the artist is missing that they can't do for themselves. And they vary, you know. I mean, I can do a lot of it for myself, but maybe the average band, you know, they need a lot more done for them and they don't know how to go about this. So I'd like to see new kinds of companies grow up that offer this smorgasbord of services to musicians, but it really needs to be music-driven. And at the end of the day, I think that the alternative for a musician is you just do it all yourself. You get directly to the fans. So what can you, you know, Acme Inc., what can you offer me to get to more fans in return for what kind of commission? And this is a fundamental change in the balance of power. You know, I mean, looking back even beyond when I started, looking back to, you know, being a film actor in the 30s, if you're Bette Davis, you're signed to MGM for 20 movies, you know. But these days, a top actor can get a movie put together around them and sell it to any studio, or, you know, sports stars, same kind of situation. There is a change in the balance of power that takes place over time. And I think that's what we're seeing here. I think it's only a matter of time before you see not only bands that come up through the online system, like, say, Arctic Monkeys, you know, you get, that can really tap into the phenomenon of MySpace, of YouTube, etc., in spite of the record industry, and get that popular. And I think it's only a matter of time before some world-class aid. Why would we want to go back to the old model? Why don't we just do this all ourselves and you know, have fans become subscribers to our site and just change the whole model? You know, let's change the world. And I think all of this is going to happen in the next few years. And I think the people that are going to really benefit from this, you know, are not here today, actually. I mean, I think we'll benefit, but I think that, you know, if you're a 16, 17-year-old kid now, the barriers are completely down. It's just a level playing field. And it's going to change not only, you know, the business, the economics of the whole thing. It's going to change the kind of music that gets made in a very, very positive way. And I think if you're a music fan, that's really good news and something to look forward to. Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes for some questions for Thomas before we go on to the next panel. So if you raise your hands, I'll call him and we'll be happy to answer.
In terms of copyright, publishing, yes, etc.
Yeah. And how do you manage the rights to your creative output, right?
That's a quicksand right there. Because if anything, you know, the record companies have been forced to change very, very quickly, but the publishing companies and collection societies and so on are very entrenched. And they have their way of doing things and the magic formulas that none of us are party to and so on, and so I can't really see that changing overnight. The other thing is that copyright law is not going to change without legislation and a lot of politics. And if you look at the history of copyright law, you know, going back centuries, technology is always ahead. There's always some new technology, you know, jukeboxes or movies or cable TV or whatever, that completely throws the existing models for copyright law into disarray. And then there's years of lobbying in Washington, and the big corporations fight back and so on, and it's just a mess. I can't really see a way around that. What I can see that is going to start happening is that technologies to actually count beans, you know, bean counter technologies, are getting a lot more sophisticated. Now, as an example, I mean, ASCAP, BMI, in the very early days of radio, there were a few hundred stations in the States, and they would ask, you know, the collection societies would make them log all of their play. Then there were thousands of radio stations, and it became unmanageable to get people to log them. So things were done on a survey basis instead of a census basis. You know, people would go sit in a restaurant and listen to what they're playing. They go to a sports stadium and write it down. They have, you know, bands on stage write down their set list. And all of that was done not on a census basis, but on a survey basis. So if you're an ASCAP BMI member, you know, you get a magical check every quarter and it says, yay, you know, here's your check for whatever it is. And you're not really able to ask them whether this is sort of based on actual statistics or whether they've got a room full of little old ladies like, you know, oh, there's my dog again. And nobody really knows. In fact, a little tip for you, you know, I'm sure this, well, I used to work in the old days, is that every now and then you write a letter to your collection society and you go, my cousin, you know, was at a disco in Memphis the other day, and he says, the DJ said that my stuff plays there all the time. This was not reflected in my recent royalty statement. And as if by magic, about 6 weeks later, you will get a letter from your collection society saying, from time to time, we have random disbursements of excess funds, and we're pleased to present you with this check of paper. So I had a friend that did that 1 year, and it worked great. So 3 months later, he did the same again. He said, you know, my brother was in Brazil, and he said that the radio station was down there, you know, here's your check for $782. Just works on magic every time. But I digress. What I was going to say is that now there are technologies that can accurately, you know, count each hit, each play. There's a thing in Shazam, I think, over here. There's equivalent technologies where, you know, you're in a bar and you hold up your cell phone and it'll actually, within 15 seconds, it'll give you a text message saying, you know, this is the Rolling Stones, Tom Women or whatever. There are technologies like that that can actually monitor radio play and so on. So there should be a much more accurate way to measure actual performance of music than exists at the moment. And, you know, databases, data mining, all sorts of web-driven technologies that in time will revolutionize the publishing business. And even if you are an entrenched company that's, you know, that's had it good for 80 years, you're going to be forced to change eventually by competition, I think. And I think it's only a matter of time before somebody mounts some serious competition for the existing copyright collection system in the US and around the world. But some little .com company is going to come along and say, look, you know, we're against those guys. We want you, the musician, someone else to come to sign with us, and we're going to do a better job than your society of collecting money for you from around the world. So I think it's going to be slower than the recording and distribution, the changes in recording and distribution, but I think it will happen over time. And like anything else, it can get really simplified, or the wastage can go away. But as I was saying earlier on, you know, it's a slightly different situation from the record labels, because it's been this weird little sort of secret, you know, this blessing in disguise. Sometimes hard to see through the disguise, but publishing has always been, you know, a little sort of pillar of the music industry, and going to change again.
You mentioned CD Baby. Do you have any comments on Taxi?
I don't actually. I know very little about Taxi. I mean, I guess I've spent, you know, 5 minutes on the website. I don't know anything beyond that. I don't know about all of these sites. I'm sure during the panels later on, you know, hear from them. I think that the way music's going long term, it's going to be more like a utility. I mean, when you take away the costs of all of those pressing plants and fleets of trucks and retail relationships and, you know, all of that wastage, music is a lot cheaper, you know, these days, to record and to distribute, I mean, just by a huge factor. And my generation, in a way, were paying for all of that nonsense. But I think these days it's a lot cheaper, and so I think, you know, we have to rethink, we have to recalibrate our sense of what music is worth. And I think actually, you know, 99 cents a song is probably way too high actually. But that'll change in time. Certainly, you know, an album should be way under $10, in my opinion. But I mean, I think that like cell phone minutes, the way, you know, as competition kicks in, you're going to start thinking of it in terms of a subscription and just, well, cell phone is a necessity. You know, I hope my bill's low this month. But I don't really, every time I make a phone call, I don't really think about how I'm incrementing my bill. I just use it a certain amount, you know, like, you know, water or gas or electricity or whatever. I think that's the way music would go. And technology has a way to do that, and has a way for us to get paid for it as well. I'm not pretending for a moment that I'm, you know, sort of typical or average in terms of what I do. It's very different. And also, I have a slightly different motivation in that I don't really need to do it to make a living now. But, you know, for the average band, I think, you know, when I was talking about CD Baby, which is really easy to understand, you know. I mean, even if you don't have a college degree, you know, you can go in there and you can, it's laid out in terms that you can understand, and this is no longer just, you know, Rod Stewart's radio playlists, magical, you know, formulas or anything like that. It's a lot easier to understand. I think what should be reassuring to the fans you're talking about is that they can come into your office for a couple of hours and you can give them some genuine feedback, and you can come up with a strategy and you can say, well, here's what you're doing well, here's what you're not doing well, in terms that they can relate to. They don't have to be involved in the minutiae day-to-day of how you're helping get their stuff out there and promote it. But I just think that you know, the divide between the artists and the public is really narrow, and I think that's great. Well, okay, I mean, I think the flip side of what I'm saying about copyrights is that, to an extent, an artist in my position was protected by the powers that be, you know, both in Washington and the record companies and so on, because, you know, the vested interest of corporations with ownership of IP is that they make it last over time, they preserve its value over time. And in a more democratic world where big corporations don't own the art, there's going to be less reason for anybody to fight, figure out ways to sort of build a fortress around that IP to enable them to still earn from it in 25 years. But that's not a big deterrent to a 17-year-old kid starting out. It's like, he never thinks he's going to make 30 anyway, you know, so I don't think that's going to be particularly a worry. I think that, you know, I think that there's an ability now, you know, because the shelf life goes away in a digital world, you know, you don't get a situation where, you know, your album only sold 5 copies last month, so we're taking it out of print, we're going to ship them all back to the factory in Berlin. You'll see a charge for that. Now you can put something, you know, online, and you'll still be selling it 5 years from now. So you have an annuity, which is just fantastic. And it's great as an artist to say, I've got my new album out, but actually the one that I did 3 years ago has spiked again because I put out the new album. Well, I did a TV appearance, and I played a song for my second album. Wow, look at the sales there. I'm still learning from that. So I actually think that you know, overall, the news is definitely good. But there will certainly be some fallout from the fact that, you know, I mean, if corporations are less able to protect the IP, you know, if art is not owned by Disney and Viacom anymore, you know, it's actually owned by the original artist, there'll be some fallout, you know. But it's fallout for the sort of the elite musicians, you know, for the Eagles of the world, really. And again, I don't think artistically that's going to have a negative impact on the world that we know. Thank you all very much.
InsideHomeRecording.com